And this is Ms. G bringing you live training here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And I hope you're ready for a couple of stories. Very short ones and maybe a couple poems if there's time. I will be back with my first story, Election Day, by Bell Boggs. Stay tuned. And this is Ms. G, bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3 in Juneau. And my story tonight is by Ms. Bell Boggs. She is the winner of the 2009 Bakeless Nason Prize for Fiction. And her first story tonight, or the story I'm going to read you tonight, Election Day. A hard frost coats the crabgrass, stiffening each blade with a fine frozen dusting that sparkles in the clear early light. Down the sloping lawn it approaches the mill, but stops short where the shadow lies. Under the cedars and boxwoods there are frost-free spaces too, damp circles of darkness around the trunks, and roots where the sparse growth was protected. The flower beds need to be cleaned for the winter. The stalks have hardened and browned, but they are marvelously unfamiliar under the frost, covered like the boxwoods and holly leaves and lawn as if by snow or sugar. Cutie stands by her kitchen window and watches, notices how even the pale silver gravel in the driveway has been touched by the frost. When she was a little girl, she liked the sound of the raised, frostbitten dirt crunching under her patent leather shoes. She remembers stomping down every bit. It's election day, and Cutie is waiting to be driven to the polling place. She has a warm mug of coffee that she must lift to her lips with both hands. They shake violently, so that each task, even eating or drinking, is a chore to be tackled alone or else abandoned. She is wearing a deep blue suit and has gotten her hair done in Tappahannock. Slept last night on a satin pillow so as not to muss it. Her good blue coat is draped over the chair by the doorway, her maroon leather gloves smooth and ready on the dinette table next to her purse. It's Loretta who will drive her in Cutie's own car, which waits in the carport. From where she stands, she will see Loretta when she pulls up, slowly in her Chrysler. And it isn't long before she does, carefully parking the car and then huffing up the steps to open the door without a knock. Cutie has grown used to Loretta's brusque ways, and she supposes Loretta has grown used to hers. Sometimes when she sees her, like now, she cannot speak or be pleasant, but must immediately busy herself with something, act as if Loretta is bothering her. Like now, she has been looking forward to Loretta's arrival, has been enjoying standing alone and expectant beside the window with the slight pressure of cold air emanating from the panes into the air before her face. But she cannot show this, must instead be impatient, rinsing her mug in the sink as if that is what Loretta's absence this morning has prevented her from doing. Sometimes Cutie thinks that it is only her age and its attending indignities that make her behave so. But when she is honest with herself, she remembers that she has been delicate in her moods all her life. "All ready, Mrs. Young?" Loretta asks. She moves to take the mug from Cutie's trembling hands, but Cutie shrugs her off by the merest movement of her back and head. Though she cannot tie a pair of shoes or drink one-handed from a cup, her body language is clear. The mug trembles and drops to the rust-stained porcelain sink, where it does not break but falls over on its side. Cutie must use both hands to turn off the tap. She turns to Loretta and says, "My coat is there." Loretta lifts and holds out Cutie's coat. She is dressed and coiffed, too. Her hair combed stiffly out from her face, a gold-colored brooch pinned to her purplish coat. And Cutie can smell a faint gardenia perfume as she eases her arms into the sleeves. Cutie takes up her purse and gloves, lets Loretta help her down the steps. They do not lock the door behind them, but move slowly toward the door, toward the car. The frost is already beginning to dull and melt beneath the sun, leaving only the dying grass. But the dirt still crunches beneath Cutie's shoes, a satisfying crisp sound. "My car is already warm," Loretta says. Cutie shakes her head. Loretta's car is nicer than her own, but that is a barrier she does not want to cross. Besides, it is only right to use Cutie's mileage, Cutie's gas, on errands meant for her. "All right," Loretta sighs. "Wait here." Cutie paces in the drive, crunching earth with her shoes, while Loretta starts and revs the engine. Smoke the color of frost pours out of the tailpipe. Loretta backs up without looking for Cutie, who must trot to get out of the way. The polling station is in King and Queen Courthouse, only a few miles from Cutie's house. Loretta has turned the heater on high so that warm, dry air blows against their skin. This part of the country near the courthouse has remained virtually unchanged for many years. There are no new stores or even gas stations, no subdivisions full of trashy plastic houses like the ones across the river. Back in the summer, Cutie's family's silver was stolen, almost every bit of it, by teenagers from one of those subdivisions. No concept of home or what it means to live somewhere you don't lock the doors. The houses they pass have been there for years, little tenant farmer houses sitting behind fields, little shacks in the woods. Cutie has owned and sold some of them herself, and it pleases her to see them there, the same as always. "It's because of the schools," Cutie's son tells her. "That's why we can't attract any Richmond people, even Mechanicsville people." "Good," Cutie says. "I don't want any strangers coming to live near me." "How well do you know these people that are here?" he asks. "I know them," Cutie says, thinking of the men who trim her boxwoods and nap under her porch, their brown glass bottles tender and glistening in the grass. "I know them like my kin," she says, and she does. She feels she knows them better than she knows Horace's wife and daughter, or even Horace. All of them so particular and strange with their dinners out and their new gadgety things, their winter vacations to places where they know no one. The road winds pleasantly with dips and hills. The cloudless sky is a pale porcelain blue. They pass Cutie's own bare fields, a squat little cinder block house she used to rent to a black family before they left for some other place. In the center of the next field is an old untended cemetery, the gravestones obscured by dry weeds and fallen tree limbs. "It's a pretty land," Cutie says approvingly. "I've been here and there, but I always say home is best." "Hmm," Loretta says. "I can't say I wouldn't take somewhere warmer." "But this is your home," Cutie insists, thinking of that family that left. Where did they go? She couldn't remember, and it hardly mattered. "You can't take something else over your home." "Haven't been too many places, that's true," Loretta says slowly. "But I suppose that could change." "I remember when husbands used to go behind the curtain with their wives," Cutie says, changing the subject. "My husband never did that," Loretta says, "but I remember it too. They told them who to vote for," Cutie says. "My husband never did either." "I don't imagine so," Loretta says, cutting off the conversation there. "You have your identification?" "I do. It is only a gubernatorial and local election, but Cutie votes every year. Even the year her son was born, she voted on Election Day, a week after the delivery for Harry Truman." The parking lot is nearly empty, so they do not have to choose between a regular or handicapped space, which always embarrasses Cutie. Inside, she is preoccupied with the slow echo of her own shoes as she makes her way across the marble floor to the card tables where ladies older than herself wait with wide paper registers. Their cotton white heads droop like flowers above the cheap tables. They wear sweaters tied around their shoulders. The two choices for governor are both fools anyway, and dishonest besides. Cutie saw the Republican's teenage daughter chewing gum on television. the Democrat will raise her taxes. But she knows that whether you voted, though not for whom, is a matter of public record. And she has a private horror of being discovered to have missed an election. She will write in her own name, as she often does. Loretta and Cutie are the first voters. They stand ready to present their licenses, but there is some problem with the books. Neither of their names can be found. "One moment," says one of the registrars, and they carry off the books. "I need to talk to you this afternoon," Loretta says in a low voice as they wait. She's fidgeting with her driver's license, and Cutie is suddenly worried. "What about?" she snaps. "My notice," Loretta says. "I want to give my month's notice today." Cutie sucks in a short, stabbing breath. "I'll make sure to give you time to find someone else," Loretta says quickly. "No," Cutie says, her voice weak and petulant as a child's. She can't possibly find someone like Loretta. Loretta is quiet and neat and competent. She has a driver's license and doesn't let anyone in the house. There was no one like that, she's sure, in the county, and she is overcome by an image of the parade of shiftless women who will try to take Loretta's place. She whispers, "If it's the money." Loretta shakes her head, looking down at her license. "I need my time, Mrs. Young," she says. "I'm not a spring chicken." In the tiny laminated photograph, she has longer hair, brushed full and shiny down to her shoulders, and a faint smile. It has never occurred to Cutie that Loretta was ever any younger than she is now. "You've left me in a place," Cutie says finally. You've left me in a real place." "Nobody's left anybody yet," Loretta says. "We can talk about it later." The registrars return with delighted faces. They have fixed the problem. They direct Cutie to the felt-curtained booth on the right. Her ballot is clamped beneath the voting machine, and she must ask before the curtain closes for the special paper ballot with the writing space. The registrars are not flummoxed this time. It is common, Cutie understands, for the stubborn-minded people around here to write in. "You may sit at our table," the registrar says kindly. But Cutie says she will be fine in the booth. She likes the dark privacy there, no one to see her hands shake as she practices her name first in the air before committing it to paper. "Cora Tyler Young," she writes finally in the space for governor. But her name on the ballot, it looks wrong. It is a stranger's name, the hands that wrote it shaking and spotted, a stranger's hands. She thinks of her age, 84, and sees the long, silent ride home, past those shacks and fields Loretta doesn't care for. The arduous trip back up the stairs to the house she has lived in since she was married. "Throwing your vote away," that's what her husband would have told her. What has it come to all that time, the effortful waking and working and sleeping of a lifetime? One name on a ballot. And what does it even matter? In her mind, she is still a little girl, shiny shoes buckled onto her feet, stomping the frozen earth flat and familiar again. You've been listening to me read Election Day by Bell Boggs. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Left Hanging here tonight, and I will be right back with more. Please stay tuned. 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Thank you. this is Ms. G, and I'm bringing you Left Hanging, and I'm back. I hope you enjoyed that last story by Ms. Belle Boggs. I know I enjoyed reading it to you. And later in the show, I hopefully will have a chance to read one more of her short stories. But first, I wanted to bring you something from Susan Orlean, a story that she did for The New Yorker back in 96. It's called Shiftless Little Loafers. Question. Why don't babies work? Excuse me, did I say more? I meant, why don't any babies work? After all, there are millions of babies around, and most of them appear to be extremely underemployed. There are so many jobs, being commissioner of Major League Baseball, say, or running the snack concession at the Olympic synchronized swimming venue. And yet it seems that babies never fill them. So why aren't babies working? I'll tell you. Walk down any street, and within a minute or so, you will undoubtedly come across a baby. The baby will be lounging in a stroller, maybe snoozing, maybe tippling a bottle, maybe futzing around with a stuffed teddy, whatever. After one good look, it doesn't take a genius to realize that babies are lazy. Or worse, think of that same baby, same languid posture, same indolent attitude, but now wearing dark sunglasses. You see it all the time. Supposedly it has to do with UV rays, but the result is that a baby with sunglasses looks not just lazy, but lazy and snobby. Sort of like an Italian film producer. You know. Oh, I'm so sorry Mr. Baby isn't available at the moment. No, Mr. Baby hasn't had a chance to look at your screenplay yet. Why don't you just send coverage and Mr. Baby will get back to you when he can. This is right about when you are going to bring up statistics about show business babies. Granted, there are some show business babies, but their numbers are tiny. For one thing, there isn't that much work. And anyway, most of it is completely visual driven, not talent driven. And everyone knows that babies lose their looks practically overnight, which means that even if baby so-and-so lands a role in a major studio feature, she'll do the work and go to the big premiere and maybe even make a few dollars on her back end point. But by the next day, she's lucky if she's an answer on Jeopardy. Modeling super babies? Same. Remember those babies zooming around in the Michelin tire ads? Where are they now? The one job that babies seem willing and eager to do is stroller pushing. Well, big deal, since A, they're actually very bad at it, and B, am I the only one who didn't get the memo saying that there was a lot of extra stroller pushing that desperately needed to be done? Besides, it's not a job, it's a responsibility. For a baby to claim that pushing his or her own stroller counts as gainful employment is about as convincing as for me to declare that my full-time job is to floss regularly. Elevator button pushing? Not a job. That's a prank. Unless you really need to stop on every floor. And have you ever watched babies trying to walk? Is it possible that they don't work but still go out for a 3-martini lunch? Of course, babies do a lot of pro bono projects like stand up and fall down, comedy, and proverbial psycholinguistic research. But we all know that pro bono is just Latin for someone else buys my Pampers. One recent summery morning, I walked across Central Park on my way to my own place of employment, where, by the way, I have to be every day, whether I want to or not. The park was filled with babies, all loafing around and looking happy as clams. They love summer. And what's not to like? While the rest of us, weary cogs of industry, are worrying about an annual report and sweating stains into our suits, the babies in the park are relaxed and carefree and mostly nude. Not for them the nightmare of tan marks, let alone the misery of summer work clothes. And what were they doing on this warm afternoon? Oh, a lot of really taxing stuff. Napping, snacking on Cheerios, demanding a visit with various dogs, hanging out with their friends. Everything you might do on a gorgeous July day if you were in a great mood, which you would be if you didn't have to work for a living. That morning, I was tempted to suggest a little career counseling to one of these blithe creatures. But as I approached, the baby turned his attention ferociously and uninterruptibly to one of his toes, and then suddenly to the blade of grass in his fist. I know that look. I do it on buses when I don't want anyone to sit next to me. It always works for me, and it worked like a charm for this, I seem to remember telling you I'm in a meeting baby. I was outfoxed, and I knew it. so I headed for my office. As I crossed the playground, weaving among the new leisure class, I realized something. The reasons babies don't work, they're too smart. That was Shiftless Little Loafers by Susan Orlin from The New Yorker from 1996. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Left Hanging, and I'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. And hello, this is Ms. G, and I'm back with another story from Belle Boggs called The Youngest Daughter. The old man delivers eggs, not because he has to, not because he needs the money. Surely he could do without the few crumpled dollars it brings. Surely the checks sent monthly by his daughters are enough. But because of the work of it is a good reason to get up in the mornings, a reason to see people. It is snowing, the first snow. On the passenger seat beside him are 3 dozen eggs, trembling in their cartons with their engines rattle, and a letter from his youngest daughter, which he opened and read in the post office. "Dear Dad," it said, "when are you going to move to L.A.?" He visited her there once, after she and her husband moved from New York, and didn't like it for all the reasons he hadn't liked New York, plus some additional ones. She likes it in Los Angeles, likes her engineering job, likes the sunshine, the palm trees, the beach. She tells him this in her letters. She does not ever try to talk her out of it. Does not say, "Your sisters live nearby, now why can't you?" She calls her hometown, where he and her mother raised her, that place. Calls it clan country. Refuses to bring his granddaughter there to visit. "Hush now," he says on the phone. "It's where we brought you up. There's no clan here." There is a story she always tells of a man who said to them when she was a girl, "There's a turkey not long dead up the road a ways." She always exclaims at the end of the story, "As if we were going to rush out and scoop it up like it was our lucky day." It's only one story among many, but it's the one she most often tells. She tries to make it funny. She does not say how the man looked at them, how he hitched up his pants and looked down at her father like he was a man who would feed his family with roadkill. That part and the fact that people used to do such things as collect dead turkey and deer from the road is a silence between them. He likes to remember how they used to pick dandelion greens and fry them in butter. Now she eats in restaurants, leaves a big tip at the end of the meal. The snow clings wet to the road and to his car, a metallic green Pontiac. It starts at most once a day. So if there are multiple places to stop, he has to leave it running and hope the engine doesn't choke. He drives slow, leans forward into the steering wheel to see the road better. He pulls into the driveway of the oldest house in the town, where the old lady whose family founded the town lives. It is the kind of town where such details matter and are known. She is stubborn, refuses to eat anything but fresh eggs from his chickens. She is mostly bedridden these days, lives in 2 rooms with the rest of her house closed up, the furniture covered in sheets. A year ago, she had good help, a nurse who kept her moving, but that woman quit, and who can blame her? Now she has a sullen woman who lives with her, is abused by her. His tires spin on snow and gravel. He pulls up behind the kitchen to wait. The woman normally fetches the eggs from his car. He can see his breath coming in white clouds from his mouth, and he gives the car a little gas, both to hurry her and to keep the engine from dying. Snow collects on the boxwoods, which are hundreds of years old, which he tended when he was younger. It does not always snow here. Where is that woman, he thinks. He grows tired of waiting, takes a carton of eggs and gets out of the car, leaves it running. He almost slips on the way to the back door. He thinks of the eggs all broken and freezing on the flagstones. No one answers. He goes inside to set the eggs in the refrigerator. It is that kind of town. There is a gasp and muffled sniffling from the next room. It is coming from the sullen caretaker who sits wide-eyed in the corner. On the day bed is the old lady propped on her million pillows, covered in afghans and tissues and torn open mail. The old lady is dead, he can tell. Her face is fragile and still and whiter than the sheets. The caretaker starts talking all at once. I found her like this. I found her this morning. I haven't touched her. The old lady's son and daughter-in-law are on a Disney cruise. There is no 911, 911 service in the town. 911 gets a busy signal. You have to dial a 7-digit number for help. The caretaker says she couldn't remember the number, couldn't think what to do but wait. She was already dead. The old man gets the caretaker a glass of water from the tap and calms her down. He is on the phone holding for the sheriff's office. There is music on the line, a country station, and he can hear his car shuddering in the drive, the idle increasing and decreasing. The snow is turning to sleet, striking window panes, oil drums, car hoods. He thinks of what he will tell his daughter. Good riddance, she'll say. That was Youngest Daughter by Belle Boggs. And this is Ms. G. I've been bringing you Love Tangy here tonight. And before I leave you for the evening, I wanted to tell you about a short story contest for Alaskan women. It's now available. It's called the Nicole Blizzard Short Story Contest, Annual Fiction Contest for Alaskan Women. And you can find out more information on the website radicalartsforwomen.org. So get your short stories ready. I think you'll enjoy entering that contest. This has been Ms. G, bringing you Left Hanging here tonight at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Until next time, good night.
Shame the Devil tells the true story of Fanny Fern, a popular 19th century journalist who overcame poverty and abuse to write about women when they had few rights.
She believes in her heart that she shouldn't have to be mistreated or abused or subordinate to anybody.
Discover the life of the once famous writer Sarah Payson Willis, who wrote under the pseudonym Fanny Fern and published numerous books of her newspaper columns and 2 novels. So why is she so little known today? We'll find out on New Letters on the Air, a production of the University.